Okay, so I wanted to do something a little bit different today. While you're just giving it out, I'll just outline it. It looks longer than it is. Really, most of it is I included just English things for you to read. The actual sources are very minimal. But basically, I felt, you know, I did this a little bit last year also. For some, it's been a bad year for, in general. It's been a particularly bad year in, you know, we've lost a lot of significant people, not necessarily because of Corona, sometimes because of Corona, sometimes it just happens. The Modern Orthodox community in particular has lost a lot of very significant personalities. Reb Rabinovich, I think right after he passed away last year, I gave a share on some of his stock. Reb Gedalia Dov Schwartz, who was the Rosh HaBezdin of the CRC and of the Bezdin of America, passed away a few weeks ago. I forget what date it is. I have no concept of time anymore, but a few weeks ago as well, Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin passed away, who was really a unique, towering modern Orthodox posek, Dati Lumi, modern Orthodox, whatever you want to call him. I felt for the last few weeks that I needed to give something on Rav Henkin. He really is a very important posek, especially in the modern Orthodox community. So that's what we're going to do. I picked some key things in his psak that I think are indicative. I included an article by him in this. This is not all to read now, but it's English. I gave it to you. Part of what motivated me was that I wanted to see what people were thinking and what I've been talking about. So I looked on YU Torah just to see, I put in Henkin, and all of one shiur has been given since he passed away. That has been uploaded to YU Torah, which bothered me a lot. I mentioned this to Atar Eis, at Nishmat, and she said, part of it is just he was more involved in Israel. There were things going into America. They just didn't necessarily upload it to YU Torah. So I was a little bit calmer after I watched the KJ had a wonderful memorial for Henkin. How about your father gave the halachic overview? Ray Schwartz gave the halachic overview of his psak. He picked some of my favorite shivot by Rav Henkin, which I debated talking about, but are ones I've given in the past. They did pick some of my favorite. Tova Genzel gave on his Parsha Nut in Tanakh, which I used for my Parsha Shiur of Migdal this week. It was a nice lineup. So I figured, we need to at least talk about it a little bit. So if you just turn to the second page, what I gave you, when I was in Toronto, I still write for them, the Kollel in Toronto does every week a translation of a piece of, they put out a Dvar Torah sort of pamphlet, which has a Dvar Torah and articles on Israel and Tanakh and things like that. And one of the things they always do is bio and translations. So a few years ago, I did Rav Henkin. I did one for next week also on Rav Henkin. But I wanted to include this piece just to introduce his personality and his bio. I won't read the bio that I wrote here, but it'll be pretty similar. Rav Henkin, like I said, was really a major postdoc in the Dati Lumi world, modern Orthodox world. He was born in America. He went to Flatbush. The guiding force in his life was his grandfather, Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, who was essentially the postdoc in America before Moshe Feinstein. He learned for 5 years Chavrusa with his grandfather, and that really shaped his worldview, and that's why his main halachic svarim, 4 volumes, are called Shutz B'nei Banim, the responsa of the grandsons, right? Because his grandfather, he also wrote English ones, responsa on contemporary Jewish women's issues, understanding Tzniut, if you've ever seen this book, right? Which is essentially a response to Oz Vahadur Levusha and the whole theology that goes along with it. Probably, if you know Rav Henkin at all, he's most known, I think, for most people in the English-speaking world, for being partners with his wife in founding Nishmat and the Yotzot Halacha. And much of his halachic writing, therefore, was in issues of Nida and contraception and things like that, which I decided not to speak about. I'm sure other people speak about these issues, you know. My wife can teach these issues. My wife is a USET. My wife teaches Nida a lot more. I teach it to men. I was not going to just give it an hour share on just like contraception and Nida questions. But Lori Novick did write an excellent piece for the Tradition online website about Rav Henkin's unique approach to Psak in Nida issues. If you are interested in the way he bask in there. A few years ago, the Henkins became more well, you know, were known for not just great things, but their son, Rav Eitam Henkin, and his wife, Nama, had been killed in a terrorist attack. But the piece that I translated a few years ago about Rav Henkin, I wanted to just start with, just so we get an idea of his Derech of Psak. This is his introduction to the third volume of Bnei Banim. I'll read you my translation just for to go quickly. he says, right, behold, I've not become old and I don't know the day of my death. Therefore, I will note some of my practices in clarifying halacha so that these words will be a commemoration for me. Your father also quoted this piece. He literally got all my favorite pieces down there. He said, when I approach a new or weighty question, He first does a cursory review of all the relevant Talmudic sources, the words of the early and late commentaries, whether we show them as a survey, even though I just dealt with their words. Then I review them a second and a third time, etc., and each time I'm more precise. I have many works by the early commentaries, and I try to look at all of them, and so too with the late commentaries. I skim all of them, and I'm also aided by, and I just put in parentheses, he lists all the books that he reads. I don't think... Right? I was running out of room by that point, but yeah, the Atamar, the Yerushalayim, Margolia, Mishnah, Avraham, Sefer Chassidim, that's right, Price's commentary on Sefer Chassidim for Toronto people, for all those references, right, for all these references, other books, and sources. Oh, look at that. This is waterproof. That's great. Okay. Who knew? I did not know I was under a waterproof roof, but I'm very happy I am, as it pours around me. Okay, fine. Sometimes I know the then he says, in volume 3 I used a computer database 2 or 3 times, although in volumes 1 and 2 I never did, right? This is something that everyone has picked up on, that he's the first Poseg that I know of that admits that he used Bar Ilan in the creation of his Shuvah, but only in volume 3 and on. In the first 2 volumes he was encyclopedic without having a database. He says, sometimes I know the conclusion I will reach in advance, and sometimes I don't. And I weigh and examine the issues while writing, removing one form and taking on another until pure flower emerges. In many places where I said something novel and then found that other books had said it, I wrote, and so X said. And if I saw it first by others, I said, as X said. Right? In many places where I said something novel that I had seen in no other book, I just wrote, because one cannot say my humble opinion in every sentence. Right? He said, if I had a chiddush, I just said it. Right, some rabbis like to say lefiyat niyadati, in my humble opinion, but as one of my rabbis once said, right, Clapper, lefiyat niyadati is a rabbinic way of saying, I have a very novel thing to say, right? The way we say it is, in my humble opinion, right? And if you have a big chiddush, right, or, right, it's like, it's the honorifics that we say. If you don't want to argue with a rishon, or a very big post that you say, lule de mistafina, which means, if I weren't afraid to say what I'm about to say, then I would say it. And then you go on to say it, right? Which is, I'm saying it, I'm just not admitting that I'm saying it. I'm pretending I'm not saying it, right? I'm saying it as what I would say if I didn't not, right? Fine. Sometimes I answer a question in Charlie without noting the question, only the insightful reader will understand. When I'm involved in a response, I might think about it while dreaming and while awake, when I'm walking in my way, when I lie down and when I get up. I get up in the middle of the meal, get off my bed at night to look at books again or to jot down an idea because it is like fire trapped in my bones. My God, remember me for good and enlighten my eyes in your Torah. Give me pleasure from the radiance of your Shekhinah in this world and the next, and my Amoraic descendants who are involved in Torah and providing merit for the community. So this, you know, is Rav Henkin's own description of his obsession with Torah, the way he felt that he needed to be encyclopedic and comprehensive when he paskins. And as he wrote, right, this was his commemoration. You know, he wanted people to remember him for this, so let's remember him for it, okay? So I was trying to think, like, you know, Rav Henkin really wrote a lot, and what could I say about Rav Henkin that would give you a taste of really his stuff? So I picked up one that he repeats in many places, but I think is really indicative. It's really important in modern psak, and it also, in many ways, for me at least, is indicative of the type of posek that Rav Henkin was. And that is the following, right? When he wrote this book, Understanding Tzniut, right? So part of what he did, it was originally an article which responded to Ozva HaDelabusha, right? So if you don't know, you all know what Ozva HaDelabusha is. You've seen it around, right? Okay. Right, it's the very, 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 very machmir book on Tzniut, which combined with halachic rulings and the stories that are supposed to motivate you to follow those rulings is a bit of a, well, there's a reason certain seminaries just ban it and confiscate it wherever it is, because it's damaging to even read it. One of my Rosh Yeshiva and Gush referred to this genre as pornographia hilchatit, right? Right? The obsessive discussion of, like, every limb in a woman's body and what has to be covered, right? Halachic pornography, he was not, right? Rav Gigi was not exactly a fan. So Rav Henkin wrote his book on Tzniut to basically counter the entire philosophy behind this. I don't want to get into the details. I have no real, you know, interest in doing that. You can read his article if you want to know his positions. It is a much more make-ill position. But what I've always found most fascinating in that book is a chapter that he repeats in several places, which is not about the technicalities. It's the following. He calls it the role of habituation in Tzniut, right? In the original article, he called it the significant role of habituation in halakha. And I'll tell you his thesis, and I want to see it, because I really do think that this, besides the fact he writes it in many places, I do think it really highlights the way he thought, at least for me, again. And that is as follows. One way of looking at all these issues, whether it be tzniut or mingling of the proper way that the sexes should mingle, or what is considered, you know, erotic for nigia purposes, right? Like all the discussions in poskim about handshakes and, right? One way is to basically try to formalize everything and say, this is objectively this, objectively that. And there is some room for that, obviously. Certain things are objectively usher. They are. But there's another way of thinking about it. And that is, I don't know why I keep getting a call from New York. This is not, okay. But I'm going to answer it after, sure. Okay. But then there is another view. And it's one he championed, which is that it isn't enough to just come up with make-ill readings of the sources, even if you think that's right. Part of it is to realize that when it comes to propriety, which is essentially what all these things are, right? What is the proper way of dealing with it? And what is you have to recognize that societies change, right? And that the rules in halakha aren't always do this and don't do that. Sometimes they are act appropriately. But a word like appropriate, by definition, forces you to be honest, look at the world, see how reality changes, and respond, which is a very messy thing to do, right? Some poskim don't like doing that, because if I do that, so things change. Oh, my God, right? I'm accepting, right? Some people don't like it because they're accepting modernity. Some people don't like it because they idealize the past. Some people don't like it because they don't like the idea that it'll be hard to put your finger on what the right halakha should be, right? Some don't like it because they want to be in opposition to the world, right? And they can't imagine that halakha just fits into the world, right? But Rav Henkin has this argument that he bases it, as we'll see in a minute, that no. Sometimes, like it or not, halakha is setting not a set of rules, but a set of principles, right? Act appropriately. Dress in a dignified way. Act in a way that is not provocative among the opposite sex. And that, as messy as it is not a rule. It's a principle. And you need to be open to the possibility that your world looks differently, and maybe that's even okay, which is a really scary thing to say, right? To say that our world doesn't look like it did 500 years ago, and that's okay, hashkafically, halachically, right? That's actually a scary thing to, for some Boston to say, but Rav Henkin was convinced, and again, I think he has similar ideas in other areas of halacha, not just Tzniut, but definitely in Tzniut. He says this a lot, but I think the willingness to embrace that possibility that the world might be different, that halacha might be societally dependent, at least sometimes, is not something that all Postim were comfortable doing, but he really celebrated, right, and was not afraid to say, which set a totally different tone for how you even talk about these things, right? Because it doesn't constantly set you up as oppositional, right? It says, look, the reality is what it is. Sometimes we just have to, not always. We don't need to just give into reality. Some things are really just usher. But not always. Sometimes reality changes, and whether you like it or not, you have to respond to the world you actually live in, not the world you wish you lived in. So what I want to do is so what I have included here is basically only four primary sources. I gave you all of Rav Henkin's article on habituation, which has been published in various forms. But I gave you one at the end of it. Again, we're not going to read all of it. I just gave you the whole article so you can look at it, right? And I gave you what I found for these purposes was a helpful review of Rav Henkin's book of Equality Lost by Rabbi Dov Linzer, pointing out basically how this approach does in many ways permeate the way that Rav Henkin viewed modernity. And hopefully this will be a little bit of a tribute to Rav Henkin, which, like I said, is really a posting you should be familiar with. Because he really is one of the best examples of what a modern Orthodox Das Yomi posting can be in terms of rigor, integrity, but also boldness and courage to poskin in a way that might not be accepted by everyone, right? And he's really, I think fair to say, modern Orthodox Das Yomi, but you look at the Haskamot and the Sefer, they're from Rabban Yosef, right? They're not from, they're from across the spectrum. Okay, so let's just get the sources down that Rav Henkin brings to bear to develop this thesis. So he writes as follows. If you look at this, source one. It's one line in the Gemara in Kiddushin. The Gemara says, "Amar Shmuel en mishtam shemin bi'isha." Right? You can't, it doesn't really translate perfectly, but it's basically, right, you shouldn't have, like, a woman as, like, serving at the table, a waitress, whatever the case may be. It includes a lot of things in that range. So, Amar Le, Ana Ki Idach Lishmuel Svirale. So, he said, so someone had, in fact, had a woman in this role, and he said, why are you allowed to do that? He said, because I hold, like, the other line of Shmuel. The Amar Shmuel, Hakol L'Shem Shamayim. Elsewhere, Shmuel just said, as long as it's for the sake of heaven. Now, what does that mean? So the Ritva says in number two, Hakol L'Fi Dav Shamayim. V'chein Hilchata. This is the halacha. Da'kol L'Fi Mash Adam Makir Batmo. Everything depends on what a person understands about himself. Imra Uilo L'Asod Archaka L'Yitzro Oseh. If you need to put extra distance because of your yeter, so fine, do that. Bafilu is stock of a vigday tivon and shalisha aser. So then it should be forbidden to look at the colored clothing of a woman. Like in Avodah Zarah. Vim makir ba'atro shiyitzro nechma. But if you recognize that that's not where you are, v'kafu flow, v'ein ma'latina klal, and it doesn't affect you, what they're low. V'staka, you can look at the clothes. L'daber ma'erva, and talk to women who are forbidden to you. Why do I keep getting this? I have no idea what's going on. Okay. Vahainu, either Rabbi Yochanan, he quotes Rabbi Yochanan, okay. He quotes several examples for example, let's see, skip down three lines, Rav Ada Bar Ava, Sha'amru, Bistubah, Nakit Kala Akatve, Barakidba, that Rav Ava at a wedding used to put the bride on his shoulders and dance with her, V'lochayit, L'rura, Mitaim, and Da'amru. Ella she'ain ra'oy l'hakel b'del chazin gadol. He's like, sure, that should only be righteous people, shemakir b'yitzro, who really know themselves. V'lo kol tamid yichamim bo'ol tamid yichamim. Not everyone can do that, even tamid yichamim, because they didn't mishmaik. Then b'kol anei udin d'maitinan. V'ashrim yishagover al yitzro v'amalo v'menutel b'tera. And luckier the people who are really controlled the Yetzer Hara, Shadivrei Tara Omnim Lo Lo Adam, Bialduto, Benotim Lo Acherim, Vintigvalet Nizignato, because Torah gives you hope in this world, when you get older, etc. Right, so the Ritzvah says, really, the rule in a lot of these things are subjective. If you know that it doesn't affect you, so then it's mutter. If for other people it does affect them, it does, sir, that's a rule. Okay, fine. So, the Yamshel Shlomo, the Shlomo Luria, in number 3, says as follows. Din v'din zeyivuar. Ha demutter levat lishen etzal v'yav, u'bein etzal imo v'kiru basar. Dafka shlo egiya bat liyud alav shana v'yom echad, v'ben liyud bet shana v'yom echad. So, when... Okay, in the Gemara you have this thing, that people used to live in, like, you know, one-bedroom houses, and when it was cold, right, the way you kept warm was that everyone piled into one bed. Right, but they didn't really have pajamas, so everyone piled them one bed, and they weren't necessarily wearing clothes. Okay? That's the background to this. That's just the reality. And the halacha was parents could be there with their children until their children were approaching majority, 11 or 12, right, girls versus boys. As long as it's at the stage where the kids are still not embarrassed to be unclothed in front of their parents, right? That's like the guide of when they've reached maturity, right? You know, little kids run around without clothes. They're still young enough that their nakedness is not sexualized, and therefore it's mutter, okay? So that's the background to what he writes. But then he says, all the way down, three lines to the bottom, he says, Ve'al zeh somchen kol ha'olam. Sorry, no, go back one more. Gam yivuar. And the rule that emerges from this, essentially, is hakol lefi mashein abroo. Everything depends on what you see, what's right to you. The gam shemosh el b'yisro, based on how you are in charge of your desires. V'yachol et gaber alav mutar lo lidaber u'sakel b'erva. And therefore, even though the Gemara, it sometimes says you should minimize talking to the opposite sex. If you live in a world where people are okay with that, and that's not provocative, so it's fine. You can talk. With a shol b'shloma and greet members of the opposite sex. V'al zeh som chirgol olam. And that's what the world does. Shemishtamshim u'medabrim u'mistaklim b'nashim. They talk with the opposite sex. They don't, right, they look at each other. They don't close their eyes when they're talking to each other. Obviously, he says, he said, I wouldn't do this in a bathhouse. Okay, that makes sense, right? He wouldn't have female attendants in a male bathhouse. That's probably reasonable. I think we can all pretty much agree that's probably a bad idea. If you personally are overwhelmed by Yitzhara, so then you should be more careful. Then don't talk to married woman. If it's going to lead you, she commit adultery, so don't do it. But feel big dish, Shimon Matzah, Liz Takel, etc. Like a Yosher says, Va'amar, Shemutzer, Leilach, Achar, Isha, Chavir, Achar, Imo, Mishun, Dizman, Azeh, Nun, Diz, Harin, Kokach, Leilach, Achar, Isha. The Gemara says, men shouldn't walk behind women in the street because it would be provocative. Like a Yosher says, no, it's not. We walk in the street normally. It's what we do. Right? People don't care. Yeah. Sorry, again? Oh, sorry. Yamshel Shlomo is 16th century, 1500s, right? He's a first cousin of the Ramah. He's a contemporary of Shulchan Aruch, right? The three basically, the main, if you remember at the beginning of the year when we talked about the three main poskim living in the 16th century who basically set the agenda for Pesach, Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, who both basically thought you could write codes in the Yamshel Shlomo. Shlomo Luria said you can't. Right, you have to write halachic analysis from the Gemara that we show, and that's Yamshel Shlomo, the 16th century. He's contemporaneous with Shulchan Aruch Ramah. Leket Yosher is recording the positions of Shuman Adeshin. So he's recording 14th century positions. Right, so we're talking 500 years ago, 500, 600, 450 to 550 years ago, something like that. These positions are emerging. This is not, right, this is not new. This is not like 20th, right, it's not right, 21st century, this is 500 years ago. And he said, already in his time, he said, people walk in the street. right? Not like Meisharim, men on one side of the street, women on the other side. They just walk. That's what we do. We don't care. I, the Gemara says it's Usser. Okay. But we're not provoked by it. It's just normal. That's normal life. So you got to change. Nowadays, we don't care too much. So what does Rehenkin derive from all this? To turn to the article, okay? Again, I just gave you the original. Again, I'm not reading all of it. I know this is longer, but I just wanted you to have something so, you know, I felt like give you something from Rehenkin, see what he does. So turn to the article. It's from tradition. It was republished many times. It's the skimming role of a habituation halakha, okay? And I want you to see how he already takes this. It's not just about tzniut for him, but it's really a statement of how much of halakha should work. So we write, one of the offshoots of contemporary preoccupation with sex is the tendency to read sexual considerations into halakha where they don't belong. Okay, that's his starting point. Right, the world, post-kid nowadays are talking too much about sex and how it affects halacha. There's too much, and he says, for example, he quotes Rabbi Meiselman, who claims that the reason that women can't read the Torah is kavod ha-tzibur. Rabbi Meiselman says, because that will elicit improper thoughts in the crowd. And as Rav Henke notes, he offers no source for such contention. Okay, that's one. And then he goes through several issues here in terms of reading. Megillah, skip all the way to the bottom of 41. A second unwarranted claim of sexual distraction as the ground for halacha can be found in an article by Ron Feldman in a recent issue of Tradition. He writes, even though there are opinions who permit women to recite Kaddish in private prayer groups, those do not permit Kaddish in the synagogue. The obvious reason for this, as explicitly stated by one rabbinic authority, is once again that men are easily distracted sexually by women, a fact which might affect their concentration on the prayers. So Rav Henkin responds, and he says, now it should be obvious that from the standpoint of hear her during prayers, there's no difference between private and public prayer. And in fact, Mate Ephraim, who presumably is the authority referred to by Rav Feldman, the Elif Lamate, prohibits a woman from raising her voice in Kaddish or any other prayer whenever and wherever women are present. Where he says, you can draw this arbitrary distinction between public and private. The post hundreds of years ago said it was a problem, thought it was a problem everywhere. Just because you don't want to say it's us or everywhere, so you invent a distinction that in shul is more problematic, he's like, that's not what the original sources say. And then he goes through it, right? So his first basic point, right, and this is why he thinks it's mutter for women to say kaddish in shul, right? He's like, look, first things first, don't read sexualization into everything in halacha. Right? It's just wrong, right? It's just, not everything is about that. But then, on 43, he sets out his main principle, and he says, one reason women's kaddish is not a source of sexual distraction in many of our communities, aside from the fact that kol v'sheerva does not apply when kaddish is only spoken, and doubtfully applies even when chanted, is that we are inured to much worse. Inurement, or habituation, plays a definitive, although almost often overlooked role in the development of halakha. Its most trenchant expression is found in the Amshel Shlomo, or Shlomo Luria, also known as Marshal, Yidushin 425, which we just read. Everything depends on what a person sees, and if he controls his impulses and can overcome them, he is permitted to speak to and look at an erva, a woman forbidden to inquire about her welfare. The whole world relies on this, and is using the services of it, speaking to and looking at women. Marshal refers first to the individual, who may not go beyond what the Talmud permits in matters of hero unless he has extraordinary strengths and qualities, but concludes with the community. When the community, the whole world, is accustomed to mingling with and speaking to women, their familiarity may be relied on to forestall sinful thoughts. The source for this distinction is the Tosfos in Kiddushin 82a. In the Gemara, Kol L'Shem Shamayim, is used by Rav Acha Bar Ada to explain the special liberty he took in using his betrothed granddaughter, this taking his betrothed granddaughter in his lap. But Tosfos writes, on our Kol L'Shem Shamayim, we rely nowadays and that we make use of the services of married women, meaning their waitresses, whatever. Tosfos would employ this principle to justify widespread practices. This is precisely the equation employed by Marshall. To prevent any mistake, it is important to be absolutely clear about which activities are subject to the mitigating effects of inurement and which are not. Habituation is an argument for permitting activities which are innocent in and by themselves, such as those mentioned by Marshall, speaking with women and looking at women's faces, and many everyday social and commercial activities which involve intermingling of the sexes. It's not an argument for permitting activities that would have explicit or implicit sexual content, in which case terror is inevitable. Mixed swimming, especially by the scantily clad, is one example. Another is mixed dancing, particularly the discotheque variety. Two youngsters doing the twist are not an acceptable couple, even if they never touch. Besides Tosro's application of habituation, another use by a Rishon of the principle is apparently found in the 15th century Leket Yosher, in the name of his teacher, Truman Adeshev. He said that it's permitted to walk behind the wife of a chaver, behind his mother, because nowadays we are not all that prohibited from walking behind a woman. Walking behind a woman is prescribed by the Talmud in Brachot 61a. And what is the meaning of nowadays we are not all that prohibited? It means that although the Talmud forbade men from walking behind a woman, lest it cause hearer, nowadays women go everywhere and we are used to walking in back of them, and so no hearer results. Among other achronim besides Marshall, the clearest use of the principle that habituation forestalls hearer is found in Mavush, written by Marshall's students from Mordechai Yaffe. It's customary to add the phrase "Shatimcha b'emeono," that is a phrase that we add in his obod and happiness in Zimun at the festive meals following wedding, Shavar Brachot. However, the 13th century Sefer Chassidim specifically excludes feasts where women sit amongst the men and here we're being present. You're not allowed to say Shatimcha b'emeono because when men and women are sitting together, it's usher because there's improper thoughts. It's not a real simcha. It's so usher. So you're not even allowed to say that simcha b'mono. That was the business of Chassidim. Lavush writes on this issue at the end of his minhagim that we do not take care about avoiding mixed seating because nowadays women are very common among men and there are relatively few sinful thoughts about them because they seem to us like white geese. That's an expression from the Gemara, meaning right, when we're in normal platonic context, right, it's not charged erotically due to the frequency of their being among us. This is identical to the approach found in Yom Tov Shlomo, and indeed, the Simcha Mono is today universally recited even in communities where there's mixed eating at Shavuot Brachot. He notes the Aruch HaTzoch once said the same thing by hair covering during davening, where if you look at the quote, for many years Jewish women have been flagrant in the thing, they go bareheaded, married women go about with their uncovered hair like girls, woke to us as a burden of our day, nonetheless, by law, it would appear to us that we are allowed to pray and say blessings facing their uncovered heads, since the majority go about this way and it's become like normally uncovered parts of the body, etc. And now he says, if you go to the next paragraph, all this complicates the task of opposing. In a number of areas of commute and interactions between men and women, there are not always fixed rules. And we have to employ knowledge of the community, psychology, sociology, which Poskim have always employed, long before the social sciences were given names, to determine what is permissible and what is not for a particular tzibor. A recent writer for the Jewish Observer found it impossible to accept that in the strictly Orthodox German-Dutch Yekish communities before the Holocaust and in their remnants around the world afterwards, mixed seating at weddings and other social events, mixed Torah shirim, and even mixed handshakes were the norm. Certainly what is acceptable there is not necessarily acceptable elsewhere, and certainly the principle of habituation has the potential of being abused and misused by the irresponsible. Applying it to halacha that exists independently of hearers, such as head covering by married women or the requirement of a mechitza in a synagogue, would be to abuse and misuse, not to mention titillating literature or entertainment. But in that, there is nothing new. So what did Rav Henkin do? Well, like I said, I think for Rav Henkin, this really is indicative of a lot of what he did. As he said, this is dangerous, right? It's very dangerous to say that the Gemara has rules. It says X and Y is usher. This is improper mixing of the sexes. And then to go and say, yeah, but nowadays people do it. So, like, it's not problematic because it's not charged in the way it once was. But on the other hand, he thinks it's true. Because he thinks that the real rules are not rules. They're principles. Don't do something with this charge, provocative. That changes. If nowadays men and women live in a mixed society, so you have to just deal with that fact, right? If you know yourself that it's problematic for you, so that's you. But if the world has changed, the world has changed, and that's okay. And you have to recognize that, even though it's dangerous, even though it might be misused. Let me just summarize, right? And I think that you see a lot of what, you know, made Rav Henkin was that he, A, was courageous, right? The fact that so many people are saying, no, no, it's wrong. He's like, I don't care. That's not what the sources tell me. Two, many of the post-him are saying it because they're wishing for a world that once was, not the world they live in. And Repenkin said, look, a post-him gets to look at the world. And you can't just pretend you're in a world you're not. He felt that post-him had to have their ears to the ground. And as times changed, recognize, as he said, and this is the danger, certain halakha, he said, don't change. Certain do. And it's hard to know which are which. And it's scary because once you start saying that certain things change, people might think that other things change even though they don't. But Rav Henkin wasn't afraid of that because he said, but in the end of the day, what's true is true. You got to respond to that. Right? And if the world you live in, this isn't true, and you have a good halakhic basis, then you got to deal with that. He says, you know, this type of attitude is what leads to, right, his embrace of women's learning, even though it wasn't, you know, traditional historically, to even train, right, to basically being a halakhic course behind the creation of the USO program where you're giving, right, women some level of halakhic. They'll be very careful what words they use, but I'll say authority, even though they'll argue that it's not really authority, but okay, you know, one day after I get my second vaccine and we're all, like, safe, and then, you know, maybe you can have, you know, we can go back to, like, people coming to people's houses and crazy things like that. Things that we used to take for normal, right, for granted, you can, you know, then you might meet my wife and you can, you know, talk about it. She can tell you, you know, all the nuances of what you have to do, what they don't do, etc., but whatever term you want to use. But he recognized the world had changed, certain things are, in the end of the day, as scary as it is, are dependent on the reality on the ground. And posts can therefore have to be willing to change, right? Not everything, and that makes it worse, right? If it was everything, it'd be easy, right? The world changed, halakha changed. If it was nothing, it'd be easy, right? Halakha is frozen. But to say, certain things are not dependent on society. Certain things are. And I'm going to be explicit that certain things are, even though I know people are going to misuse it. But I need to be honest. Right? That's not an easy thing to do. Yeah. You gotta speak up because, like, there's like a monsoon behind me and, like, yeah. You're on the Aruch HaShulchan about hair covering? Yeah. Right. So, right, according to the Aruch HaShulchan, if you live in a place where, like, everyone covered their hair and you were never exposed to it or didn't cover their hair, presumably according to the Aruch HaShulchan, you wouldn't be able to say Shema. Right? Because for you, it would be something novel. Again, right, so then you got to figure it out, right? Meaning if it is, it's someone who's actually provocative for them, so then presumably you wouldn't be able to take Kriya Shema because it's distracting. For someone, right, once he gets to the point where he's habituated to it, then, you know, again, I should just, parenthetically, I should just note, right, the Aruch HaShulchan doesn't make the argument that habituation makes it mutter. There are people who did, right? Not a majority, but there were posts who said that covering hair itself was just based on societal norms, and therefore if people, married women, don't cover their hair, then it's mutzal chatzila. Most poskim did not take that direction, and the Aruch HaShulchan is not taking that direction. He's just saying that if a woman isn't covering her hair, it no longer provokes, and therefore you can say Shema, even though she should be covering her hair. There are poskim who didn't take that direction, that's not the Aruch HaShulchan or Repenkin, it is other people, but, you know. Yeah, presumably. I think so, yeah, for sure. Assuming he's in a place where he will be seeing the women in a way that is provoking, yeah, I think so, for sure. Good, right, so this is why I was, like, very hesitant to do this topic, just because, right, as we'll see, a lot of the issues, and, I mean, it's not accidental. Rav Henkin was very involved in quote-unquote women's issues, right, if you want to call it that, but fine, right? So, yes, he does bring it up a lot there. And we'll see that, you know, I think Ray Linzer does a nice job at highlighting where it comes up elsewhere in Rav Henkin's psak. You know what? Let's look at it, because you'll see, right, that, yes, many of the issues that modern people will talk about are women's issues, but you'll see, it comes up in a lot of areas of halakha, You know, he lists some, which you would not expect. Yeah. Non-Jews what? I mean, the returning the oven is because you know it's part of creating intimacy. That's not that people do intermarry, and intimacy is a particular problem. That hasn't changed. No. So that's because of chas, right? Visual akum is chasnud. The avodah zarah one, right, might change. So you're right. Sometimes it does. Some things change, some things don't. And as we're hanging notes, it's hard to figure out which one's which. We'll see. So yeah. So let's look at Ray Linder's survey here, right? So he knows that turning to the halachic section of the book, right, because equality law says parshanut in the Torah and halacha, the reader is struck by the degree to which a historical and sociological sensitivity pervades Rav Henkin's halachic writings. And this is the first page. Rav Henkin is inclined to understand earlier readings in their historical context and thus limit their applicability. In the early 18th century, Chavot Yair prohibited women from saying Kaddish. The response to them is regularly quoted by those who prohibit women from saying Kaddish today. In response, Rav Henkin demonstrates that at time, and indeed until the mid-19th century, only one person would say Kaddish for the entire congregation. Right? You know that, right? The original meaning was only one person at a time would say it on behalf of everyone. So a woman saying Kaddish meant the woman was the chazan for Kaddish, for the shul, essentially. Right? Under today's practices, where all mourners say Kaddish in unison, a woman would be ready to say Kaddish together with male mourners. In the same article, Rav Henkin also limits earlier rulings on the basis of their sociological and cultural context. Thus, the rulings of some Sephardi poskim that prohibit women from saying Kaddish are similarly deemed irrelevant inasmuch as their conception of the propriety of a woman saying such prayers is at odds with the Ashkenazi one. But then look at the next paragraph. Recognizing historical and cultural differences is important not only for contextualizing rulings of other poskim, but for understanding the scope and applicability of Talmudic rulings as well. In his article, Hero and Community Norms, Rav Henkin defends the modern Orthodox lifestyle that allows for intermingling of the sexes. Right, similar to the article we just saw, I said, he says this in many places. Talmudic passages voice concern that such intermingling may lead to illicit sexual thoughts. He argues that as a result of habituation, such neutral intermingling is now non-sexual and thus permitted. Rav Henkin is quick to point out that the vast majority of Talmudic edicts are categorical and not open to contextualization. However, some areas can be legitimately contextualized, and it is critical to identify what they are. In the case of prohibited provocative behavior, some Rishon Macharim already state this to be determined on the basis of individual or societal circumstances. But now, right, Rabbi Linder notes, but the same type of argument comes out in totally different areas. So, for example, other cases may be found in the Tosos discussion of the rabbinic requirement for Mayim Achronim and the prohibition against clapping hands on Shabbat. Right? Right? Totally different areas. Tosos says, the Gemara says, don't clap on Shabbos. Because if you clap, that will lead you to use instruments. If you use instruments and your instrument breaks, you'll end up fixing it. And Tosos says, we don't know how to fix instruments. You can clap. Right? Now, I remember once being by Rabbi Reuven Feinstein when I was in high school, because he came to my community for Shabbos, and he had a thing Friday night for teenagers, and he said, look, if you think that halacha changes based on society, assuming that that's true in this case, he thinks that any honest person would say nowadays you can't clap. Because if it's based on the reality, so in the time of the Gemara, they knew how to fix instruments. Maybe in the time of Tosafot they didn't. But now, how many people who play a guitar don't know how to fix the string, which is Mago Patish? Honestly, right? He's like, if you're based on the sociological reality of Tosafot, nowadays people know how to fix their instruments. Not all of them, not your grand piano maybe, but your guitar. Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, no, so it wouldn't be person to person. Presumably this would be society to society, right? But he says, in Tosa's time, no one knew how to fix their own instruments. That was something experts did. Nowadays, it's not. So Reuven Feinstein argued that if it's sociological, so then if it can change, it can change back, right? I've been convinced of that since I was in high school, right? Was that if it's sociological and it changed, then it should have changed back. So that's my, you know, I've been convinced by that argument, but it's true, right? Tosafot basically takes the same argument and says, yeah, clapping and dancing on Shabbos is a subset of that. Now, it's weird because technically Tosafot's argument should, though he himself says it doesn't, lead to saying you're allowed to play instruments on Shabbos also, right? That should be the conclusion, right? Because the only reason you can't play instruments is for the same reason, right? This is a derivative of that. So that does create a bit of a halachic quandary. No one really knows why Tosafot said what he said, right? Rav Asher Weiss has a summary somewhere where he just says, like, yeah, there is no predictive way of figuring out when Tosafot decided it was sociological dependent and when it wasn't. But, okay, it's clear that Tosafot sometimes does it. Literally, this was, some of you know Rabbi Brody from Tikva. Yeah, this was his dissertation, was when do we say that you need that rules are formal and therefore cannot be unrooted when society changes, and when do you say not? That was his dissertation, okay? It's a very complicated topic, but the point is that Tosafot says it. And Tosafot also says it by Mayim Achronim, right? The Gemara says, wash your hands after a meal before benching because there are sharp salts, Melech Sedomit, that will blind your eyes if it gets into your eyes. Tosafot says, our salt isn't that sharp. We don't have Melech Sedomit. You don't have to wash your hands before benching. Right? You don't have to do Mayim Achronim. Again, Shulchan Aruch, Paskins, you do have to. The Rambam, Paskins, you don't have to. Right? Like Tosafot. But again, Tosafot is clearly open to that being based on the reality. What type of salt do you have? Right? This is not a raya. It's not, right? It's Tosafot recognizing sociological reality. Right? In my house, we have a bit of a machloket on this. I'm, in that sense, a bit of a formalist, and I insist on washing my hands and doing my machronim before benching with a cup. My wife does not. So at some point, my kids, my 5-year-old, my 7-year-old, have a chavrusa themselves in Pinini Halacha Liladim. So Ora was walking by when they were up to the section of Mayim Achronim, and my 5-year-old asked my 7-year-old, we never talked about it, just what I do, right? Like, I never brought it up. So, but my 5-year-old asked, right, and this teaches you kids are always watching, said, what's Mayim Achronim? And Mayer said, it's that thing that Abba does and Ima doesn't, right? So kids are always watching, so, you know, they notice halachic discrepancies. So, you know, it comes up in different places, but as right, Linzer notes, the challenge for a posseg is to know when such arguments can and should be made. It requires a courageous posseg to apply this approach when it is warranted, rather than to reject it out of hand because of the threat it represents. Rav Henkin also argues for recognition of the evolving nature of halacha. He states that an honest assessment of the evidence demonstrates that rulings are rarely closed, and even the Shulchan Aruch is not treated by poskim as absolutely definitive. Decisions are always open for review, and different halacha may prevail in different communities. Halacha is an ongoing process, not some static monolith. For Rav Henkin, then, halacha is not unchanging. Quite the contrary. Current halacha is in a stage of an ongoing process, different for different communities, and always subject to review and revision. While halacha as a whole must not be historicized, it is critical to realize that in specific cases, some of its norms are contingent on certain historical and sociological realities. Right now, again, as you read Rabbi Linzer's review, you see this is very dangerous because much of halacha is not like this. And recognizing that many areas of halacha are is very dangerous because it could lead to people doing that to all of halacha. In the Orthodox community, there is strong resistance to this approach, and the fear of its potential abuse is intensified by the conservative movement's frequent use of the historical method in its halachic process. Right? Rav Lichtenstein made this point once, that a lot of things like kavod abriyot should be used more by poskim, but they're scared to use it because people in non-Orthodox communities misuse them. So therefore, Orthodox poskim are scared to use them at all, even when they should be invoked. Right? And it takes a courageous poskim to say, look, yes, some people misuse it, but it's still true, so you have to invoke it when necessary. It should thus come as no surprise that when Henkin uses this mode of analysis in an article in Tradition to justify the intermingling of sexes in modern Orthodox communities, it earned him the ire of Tradition's former editor, Emanuel Feldman. Who is this all-knowing posek who determines which acts produce or do not produce erotic thoughts? Could not Henkin's theory be applied to annul the laws of Yichud? Seclusion with a forbidden woman, since their intent is to restrain a possible rush of sexual ardor that might lead to sin? Could not one argue that in our endured society there's no need to be concerned with this? Rav Henkin's application of this theory ignores the well-known principle that Torah laws are made for all times. Right? This was the critique against Rav Henkin. Although, now, right, Lizer continues, although in his article, Repenkin had anticipated these challenges and emphasized that habituation is only relevant to specifically defined areas of halakha, his statements apparently fell on deaf ears. The fact that a posek of impeccable credentials, such as Repenkin, is subject to such derision, particularly in regard to a point which he had already explicitly addressed, is further comment on the depth of the resistance to this approach and the courage required to apply it when it is justified. Beyond an awareness of historical and sociological realities, Repenkin's pragmatic orientation often brings about a significant shifting of the locus of the halachic problem. For example, some poskim discourage women from attending a women-only Megillah reading because of the absence of a minyan of 10 men and questions as to the proper blessing to be made. Against such formalistic halachic considerations, Repenkin posits the very real concern that women are often unable to hear or even attend the regular Megillah reading, making the smaller women's readings the halachically preferable one. Right? Similarly, in a sport, right, and this is just a recognition of the fact, right, like time concerns. Right? Specifically, similarly, in a short response, he addresses the phenomenon of mothers who bring their small children to the synagogue, thereby disturbing the services. The questioner wished to require that such women stay at home with their children. Repenkin responds that the solution is not to exclude mothers from the synagogue, but for the synagogue to provide childcare. Such an obvious practical point is often lost even on the most progressive synagogue rabbis and presidents. Right, so where Elinger points out is that Repenkin was just, in general, right, he was pragmatic in the way he applied halacha, even if it made people scared, right, because on the halachic level, it's scary, but he said the same common sense approach led to practical advice that shouldn't be controversial, right? Saying you should have childcare at shul is not controversial, right? That's, right? And yet most people don't think about it, right? But if you're the type of person who thinks that halacha works in the real world, you think about these things and you incorporate that into your formal psak, which is solve it not halachically, solve it by having a head on your shoulders, right? You know, I tried. When I was in Toronto, I really tried to get a staggered, like in when I was in the Kollel in Gush, and this is what we do in Efrat now, right? We have staggered minyanim. We have a vasikin minyan on Rosh Hashanah, and then the late minyan, where it's basically timed, right, that the vasikin minyan can finish before shofar blowing, right, in the main shul, right? That's like the staggering, right? This way, usually fathers, though not exclusively, can go to the early minyan, be finished, and watch the kids while their wives go to hear all of shofar and musaf in shul like human beings, right? And I tried, right, really hard in Toronto to institute it, right? Because I said, look, this is not a halakhically controversial thing. It just requires a bunch of people who think that their wives should be able to go to shul and that men should be willing to wake up early to make that possible, right? That's all it really requires. It's not really halakhic, right? It's just, it didn't work. The reason was not because, probably partially because people didn't want to wake up early, but mostly because everyone has nannies, right? In Toronto, everyone has nannies, so therefore there was a very few, right? We were like one of the few families who didn't have nannies, which, you know, it's not as common outside. Look, when I'm in the Clanton Park area, my father-in-law is the gabbai of the Vasikin Minyan. You know, that was part of it. It was like, that's like, you know, that is the family minyan. Everybody wakes up for Vasikin, you know. If you have a heartbeat, you wake up for the Vasikin Minyan. That's not, you know, Ura's family is like, that is the minyan we go to. That's not a question. It did not work in the Bayit, but that was fine. But again, what Ray Linzer points out is that, you know, Henkin's recognition of the world changing and how that affects halacha, sometimes not even a halachic point, it's just like a practical point, right? Like, he was just pragmatic, right? So sometimes it was courageous to say, yeah, halacha sometimes changes because it's societally dependent, which, as you see, some people yell at him, even though he acknowledges that it's not all of halacha, and certain areas of halacha you can't escape it. Sometimes recognizing the importance of the reality just means that you should come up with practical solutions that are not even halachic, right? That was just the type of person he was. He cared to make things better based on understanding the world as it is. What is and is what is not halacha? Rav Henkin is careful to distinguish what is and what is not included in halacha. For example, Most Orthodox Jews believe that tzniut is primarily the obligation of women. A clear look at the story, though, reveals that in many circumstances, it's the man's obligation not to look lustfully at women, rather the women's obligation to distance herself from the gaze of men. This, Rankin states, is what the halacha is, community assumptions notwithstanding. Such distinctions can have profound practical implications, and it's worth speculating how the religious roles of men and women might shift and the status and self-perception of women might be transformed if this halachic point were internalized. Rankin also completely rejects the masking of public policy opinions as halacha. Right? And he said, right, if you have a policy thing, don't shape it as halacha. You would disagree with me on policy? Call it what it is. Call it policy. He believes it appropriate for a rabbi to make a public policy argument and perhaps even to forbid certain behavior on public policy grounds. But when doing so, he must be careful not to cloak his position in halachic language. Moreover, a rabbi's policy decisions are not binding ex cathedra. He must be prepared to argue for and defend his positions on public policy grounds, weighing all the various pros and cons on the issue. Public policy tends to be used selectively, depending on the issue being discussed. In the case of organ donation and brain death, for example, it's usually the more modern post can provoke public policy considerations. On the other hand, it is often the same post can limit themselves to discussion of technical halacha and do not address the public policy issues in the case of a women's prayer groups. Public policy considerations are very real, and they need to be addressed honestly, not merely employed as a tool to achieve a desired end result. In the case of women's prayer groups, such a discussion would seek to honestly evaluate and balance such issues as traditional gender roles, covered a breed of inclusiveness. Rav Henkin's call for a separation of halacha from public policy is most welcome, as an open and honest debate of public policy considerations on their own merits can only benefit the Jewish community. A balanced posik. Rav Henkin's non-static view of halacha, his decoupling halacha from public policy considerations, and his practical orientation all work together to allow for innovative solutions. It would be a mistake, however, to characterize Rav Henkin as a mekil, a posek who is regularly lenient. Rather, he rules according to his best understanding of the sources and the circumstances, which at times will call for forbidding certain activities. On the basis of a careful analysis of the primary sources, he rejects the position of those who limit the restriction of Kol Isha to cases of the recitation of Shema. And again, on the basis of a close reading of the sources combined with policy considerations, he argues vehemently against those who would permit a Beit Din to convert children who are being raised in non-observant homes. As he himself puts in another article, we are halachic Jews, and we should accept with faith and love even those disabilities and restrictions which halacha may place on us. In areas of public policy, Rav Henkin similarly weighs each case on his own merits. In the case of women saying Kaddish, he is willing to pit his policy of inclusiveness against others' policy of limiting women in the private realm. In contrast, he rules that while women's aliyot are technically permissible on the grounds that a congregation can waive its honor, this practice should be prohibited on public policy grounds because such a congregation would eventually lose its Orthodox affiliation and commitment. While others may legitimately argue with his conclusions, Rav Henkin is a posek of integrity who rules according to his best read of the sources and circumstances. Right, and this is really what I would want to leave you with on Rav Henkin. Right, is that Rav Henkin, you know, is in many ways a model of what a modern posek is, because, right, as Ray Linzer analyzes, first of all, he really believes that halacha has to have its posek need to understand what's going on in the world. Some halacha doesn't change, and you have to admit that. Some halacha is societally dependent, and you have to admit that, even though it's dangerous, because once you admit one, right, you can be bludgeoned from either side, right? The people who think, who will say, look, conservative people use that to change all of halacha, you have to say all of halacha is unchanging. Or people who say, once you say halacha changes, everything changes, right? To say how some halacha does, some halacha doesn't, and you need to look at the source with integrity is a hard position. But two, is that understanding that halacha is based on the reality as it is, isn't always about halacha. Sometimes it's just about being a good leader, right? Getting child care, right, is in shul so that women can go to shul. This shouldn't be controversial, right? It's just about understanding the reality and what people need, right? So, yes, understanding the reality is important for halacha, which is highly dependent, but it's also important just for responding to the world as it is. Rav Henkin wasn't someone who was afraid to say, it's okay that the world has changed, and he wasn't afraid to say, but it doesn't always change. Right? And, as Ray Linzer notes, he wasn't afraid to say, look, opposing is a lot of care about halacha and policy. You're allowed to say something's mutter, but I think it's a bad idea. But you have to be honest, even though that weakens your stance. right? Some Muslim are afraid to say, I think this is Mutter, but it's a bad idea, because then they think no one will listen to them. So they have to couch it in halakhic language. Rav Henkin wasn't afraid to say, look, I'm willing to be honest and say with integrity, I think this is Mutter, but a bad idea. You know what? Take it or leave it. You don't like it, fine, but I'm going to be honest. And therefore, right, Linder knows, he wasn't consistently lenient. Right? And some things, he thought the halakha didn't change, even though other people think it is societally dependent. Right? Sometimes he was more lenient, sometimes he was more machmir. But what you see is a posek who is committed to halakha, to recognizing the complex reality we live in, figuring out when halakha changes, when it doesn't, when we can solve problems through pragmatic concerns rather than halakha, and when we have to talk policy and be honest about that. All those things are really important in contemporary stuff, right? Because so many Poskim are afraid to recognize that the world changed or admit it, or to admit that sometimes they think things are bad ideas, but not, right, but not actually usher. But then, if you're not honest, and you're not honest about reading reality, you're not honest about what you really think, right, you can't have a fruitful conversation about how halakha has to work in a complicated modern reality. And it really is, as I said, you know, this attitude, which yes is most pronounced in Sion issues, but not only, really in many ways typifies for me why I love Rav Henkin so much in his tshuvot, because he really is so thorough, tries to be creative and original and unafraid to say what he thinks, whether people on the left or the right are going to be angry at him. But he really, right, reminds us that good stock, especially in the complex modern world, has to take the reality as it is, respond to it, recognizing that sometimes halakha will change, sometimes it won't, right? Sometimes policy will change, sometimes it won't. But you need to be able to be honest about it and assess the world as it is, and halakha as it is, with integrity. And that's not easy. But it makes someone a good posek, especially a good modern posek. So that was what I wanted to just sort of share some ideas that, again, I think are central and emerge from Rav Henkin's works. There are a lot of other things we could say about it, but, you know, he's a person that we should know about. You know, it's really a loss to the community that he passed away. But he really, you know, provided with such integrity so many seconds that are important to our community that, you know, it was worth at least getting a share to exploring some of his thoughts. I know this is more frontal than normal, but I just felt like I needed to get this my chest. It's, you know, important that you know who he is. And, you know, I encourage you to read his stuff. If you can't read the Hebrew, plenty of his stuff is in English. He's American. It's not even, right? It's his translation, right? That's true of his tshuvot, whether it be his Tzniut book, women on, you know, contemporary women's issues, his parshanut on the Torah and equality law. And if you can read some of the Hebrew stuff, there's a lot more material there. Mahalchim Bamikrach, Higayiterah, really a lot of what, and obviously the four volumes of Bnei Banim, which have all been uploaded now to Sfaria, so they're easily accessible in, right, even if you don't have the volumes. And he's really a model. You know, I heard from Rabbi Schwartz, from Rabbi Henkin, that a few years ago, Nishmat published a Nishmat Abayit, which was a collection of tshuvot from the hotline, from the OSN hotline. And Rabbi Henkin said that one of the reasons she published it was because Rav Henkin reviewed every question that was published on it, and so many have stuck in because he was in you know, failing health for many years, just never got published, and she just felt she needed to get his Torah out there. And so she needed to, you know, publish another book that would get some of his Torah out there. And at some level, right, you know, I felt that I needed to do that, just get his Torah out there so more people are acquainted with him, and hopefully that inspires you to read some of his other stuff, which is excellent. And, you know, one of my students at Migdal asked me a relevant question yesterday. I gave him this book, and, like, just today he got through, like, half of it. He's like, oh, now I understand why you, like, love him and why you miss him and why he's such a loss to our community, because he's just such a perfect example, him and his wife, or just perfect examples of what it means to, right, be serious about Torah with integrity, and still be able to change and accomplish important things, right? Meaning, you know, I owe a debt of gratitude to the Henkins in general, right? Like, you know, as I said, my wife is the OSN. She's benefited from the world that was created by the Henkins. It's not like, you know, like I know firsthand how much it has influenced the world. And I felt like at least we should do a little bit of a tribute to it. But again, I really do encourage you to read it. If you want to, you know, just be more of a tribute to him, you can find the KJ one. It was really nice. It was really well done. It was Ray Schwartz did a survey of his halacha. Gina Zimmerman did a survey of his contributions in Nida and related issues. She was one of the first to give us out, and also is a very high ranking doctor in the Ministry of Health. She has, you know, a good double perspective. So again, Gensel wrote about his parshanut in the Torah. Who else spoke there? One of his cousins spoke about his love of music and sang some family tunes that they have. Right. It was a very nicely balanced thing that tried to get his perspective from different angles. It was nice. Okay, he's Zichro Baruch, and we'll go back to probably more normal here next week, even though I do it some